Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we will, as we await the speech by the President of the United States at the University of Arizona in Tucson, he will be preceded, starting in a few minutes, by the University President of the University of Arizona, Ronald Shelton, and then Janet Napolitano and Governor Brewer and student leaders will speak. It's expected that the President will come on about 5:35 local time. But before then, we'll be joined by Jacob Heilbrun, who's a senior editor at the National Interest, at the National Interest and author of the newly released They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. He was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and senior editor at the New Republic and a Japan Society Fellow. His articles have been published in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal, Commentary, and the Washington Monthly. And we'll be talking about what is expected of President Obama's speech in this contentious political climate that has been much discussed of late. And then we'll be joined by Ron Suskind, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. His books include The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, and The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill. He's currently writing a new book. Thank you for joining us, Jacob Heilbrun.
Thank you, Ian.
And I suppose the news today is Sarah Palin's Facebook, which was an attempt to calm things down, but her reference to blood libel has stirred things up, has it not?
Yes, and I don't think that was inadvertent. Howard Fineman in the Huffington Post said that that is really the first salvo of the 2012 campaign launched by Palin. And she obviously thinks that the best defense is a good offense. But I and many other people found it a deeply offensive statement for a variety of reasons, not least because she is profiling herself as the true victim of the Arizona massacre.
But how could resorting to anti-Semitism, whether it's conscious or unconscious on her part, help her launch her political run for President of the United States?
Well, I think they miscalculated. But it does fit with her modus operandi, which is to be extremely truculent and to try and demonize her adversaries. I think personally that she lacks an internal governor and is lurching out of control, and that the more the campaign goes on, the more it will be seen that she simply is glaringly deficient next to the sobriety of President Obama. Whatever his flaws, Obama has conducted himself very seriously as president, and I think few people believe that Palin has the necessary detachment and judgment to actually be president, and she's demonstrated it again today.
Well, that would indicate then, Jacob Heilbrun, that she's the best possible thing that could happen to President Obama, because given the state of the economy, which already clearly contributed to what President Obama referred to as a shellacking in the last election, the head of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, the economy is not going to get any better soon, and certainly not in less than 2 years. So it would seem to me that he's already got an albatross around his neck, and she may come to the rescue, and which I think is probably why the Republican establishment will do everything that they can to stop her.
Well, the establishment is quaking before Palin, but it doesn't mean that she won't be a very strong candidate in the primaries. What the 2012 primary will show us is the depth of the right-wing hold on the primary process. And that base may be energized by statements like today. I mean, it's been shown that Andrew Breitbart and others on the right have already used the term blood libel. It does not originate with Sarah Palin. It's been in circulation on the right. And Palin may also be making a calculated decision that she needs to continue to outflank her probable adversaries, such as Mitt Romney or Tim Pawlenty. But I do think that in the general election, these statements will come back to haunt her.
So, Jacob Haugen, again, senior editor of The National Interest, the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. He was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and senior editor at The New Republic. And we're talking about what the president – actually, we're talking mostly about Sarah Palin's remarks today on her Facebook in defense of what she referred to as a blood libel, where journalists were defaming her and stirring up the very hatred and division that they purported to want to subdue. I'm sort of paraphrasing what she wrote. But we're waiting for the President of the United States, who will be speaking at in about 30 minutes from now at the University of Arizona. The university president is expected to speak first. And then former governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano, now head of Homeland Security, will also speak, along with Governor Jan Brewer and student leaders. So Palin had to take down all of that stuff from her website of how she targeted Gabriel Giffords. And it's extraordinary. You know, I even get mail, people complaining that I'm libeling her by saying she put targets on Congresswoman Giffords. Congresswoman Giffords herself, back in March, when people vandalized her office over her vote on health care, she went on MSNBC and blamed Sarah Palin and castigated her in a very dignified way, which turns out to be kind of very prescient and very moving in retrospect, where she made it very clear that she held her Palin responsible for targeting her, both literally and figuratively. And then Palin took these symbols, which she herself referred to as bullseyes, off. And then her spokespeople said, no, they were symbols that surveyors use on maps. So who's writing her stuff?
Well, she's very tightly connected with Randy Schuneman and Michael Goldfarb and others. And
Schuneman was the national security advisor for John McCain's campaign.
Right. I mean, essentially, there is a strong neocon conservative component to Palin. She manages actually to bridge the divide between the neoconservatives and the Tea Party types, and which is why she'll be a potent figure in the primaries, in the Republican primaries at least. I mean, she is considered to be the front runner. We can't forget that. So what? If she continues in this vein, it'll be interesting to see whether she just sinks.
Well, the neocons discovered her. Fred Barnes and Bill Kristol were on a sort of right-wing cruise where they were speaking to the faithful, and then they went ashore and met her and apparently bonded. And Kristol really pushed her campaign pushed McCain to put her on the ticket, and has been her, I think, number one advisor. But I thought the motives for the neocons, putting her up as their candidate, was quite simply that she was stupid, and that they liked the fact that George W. Bush was an empty vessel that they could fill, and that's not my description. That's what Richard Perl said about candidate George W. Bush. So that's my impression. What's yours?
Oh, I couldn't disagree with you on that, Ian. I mean, that has been the neocon approach to be the advisor behind the throne to the prince, or in this case, princess. And the neocon doctrine, fell out of favor, of course, after the Iraq invasion. But they always need, it's a small group of intellectuals who need a champion, a horse, so to speak, who can propagate the doctrine and give it political viability. which I don't really think there are very many neoconservative politicians. It's more of an elite movement. So, yes, Palin would fit the bill perfectly.
But Jacob Harburn, again, the Senate editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and senior editor at the New Republic, and in advance of the president's speech at the University of Arizona, where he's preceded by the president and Janet Napolitano and Governor Brewer and student leaders, we're talking about, largely talking about Sarah Palin, which may be a mistake in as much as where we should be talking about what the president's going to say.
Well, I think Palin provided a foil for Obama today, and she obviously tried to preempt him. I mean, we're getting into the interstices of the political decisions when, well, that's why I found Palin's statement objectionable as well. There's a mechanistic utilitarian quality to a lot of the commentary on the right, which is they're not really concerned about the event per se. They're simply concerned with
being associated with it, yes.
With how they come out of it politically.
Sure, I mean, right.
There's something a little creepy about it.
There most certainly is, and there is also a absolute chorus of indignation from all the people on the right. They're all on the same hymnal, crying foul that how dare people... I mean, it's such an absurd argument. Of course, these things aren't mutually exclusive. Atmosphere can contribute to these kind of tragedies. At the same time, it doesn't necessarily indicate the sole responsibility for the act. So
no, and even if it's not connected, which it might not be, it still has to give everyone pause because of the level of vitriol and the sense that something has gone awry when our best and brightest are gunned down for being moderates. And you have whether you know, the right-wing rhetoric is directly responsible or not, it certainly has to leave a bad taste in everyone's mouth, which is what it's doing, and that's why they're so alarmed.
Well, then, just in closing...
Well, even Roger Ailes, though, by the way, did apparently tell the Fox anchors, tone it down.
Sure. Well, they still went after the sheriff in Pima County, and they still seem to be fairly dutiful in terms of being the Pravda of the Republican Party. But just in closing, Jacob Harburn, what about the comparisons to Bill Clinton's speech after the Oklahoma City bombing at a similar time in his presidency, where he took a shellacking and he turned things around with his speech? Is the president going to do that today?
Well, I think Obama actually already did seize the high ground at the end of the last term. I mean, I think he's got the... He's already got the whip hand, if you want to look at it politically. This speech may just remind people of why they admire Barack Obama in the first place, because I assume that he will give a dignified and moving address. And, you know, this is sort of the thing that Clinton was very good at, but I think Obama is even better at... there is a national sense of unease and grief, and I think my expectation is that Obama will do a magnificent job of reflecting that and addressing it tonight.
So why is it then that the conservatives, particularly the Tea Party types, can't man up and admit that they've been saying this stuff for the longest time, that the president's a terrorist,
I mean,
that healthcare is socialism and all this crazy stuff. They've been saying it day in and day out, and now they're saying, oh, how dare you associate what we said with what happened. It's not that there's a direct linkage with what happened, but at the same time, they have been saying the most poisonous and outrageous stuff for months and even years.
Well, it is interesting that conservatives who have always decried the idea of victimhood and called for self-reliance are now stylizing themselves as the victims, aren't they, Ian, of this Arizona tragedy, instead of focusing on...
Yeah, but I think they're being cowards for not owning what they've said. And
I agree. You know. But there's a lack of self-reflection,
sure,
and a refusal to engage. But again, it's all seen as a political warfare in the end.
Well,
they're not going to concede any ground to what they view as the enemy.
Right, right.
And they view themselves as besieged and unfairly attacked.
Right. No, there's a streak of martyrdom that goes through all of this stuff. And even on the religious right, there's a sense that they're beleaguered, and there's a sense throughout the right that they're beleaguered. They actually believe in the lamestream media's liberal bias dominating the media. And frankly, from where I sit, I know that the liberal voices in this country are all but extinct.
Well, conservatives tend to have a pretty apocalyptic view of America as going down the drain, but for their efforts to hold back the liberal tide. Well, and so, yes, they live in a constant state of beleaguerment and view the American government itself with hostility.
Well, it is a very, very unpleasant time that we've been living through and continue to live through, and one can only hope that the president is able to put things into context and at least, if he can't heal the divide, at least calm the rhetoric. I thank you for joining us, Jacob Harbron. Again, Jacob Harbron is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. He was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and senior editor at The New Republic. I'm now speaking with Ron Suskind, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. His books include The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, and The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill. And Ron, you're working on a new book. Does it have a title yet?
No, Ian, it doesn't. All I say is it's a book about America. It'll be out this year.
Well, America's sure in the news. Not that it ever isn't, but it's to some extent on trial, I think, at home and abroad, in terms of what's happened, where a congresswoman was shot down along with a lot of innocent civilians in a massacre that has become all too frequent in this country. And this will be the second time the president has spoken after a massacre of this sort. Of course, he spoke after the Fort Hood massacre. What do you expect him to say, Ron? Because there's an expectation that he has to rise at least to the levels of President Bill Clinton's speech after the Oklahoma City bombing, which happened at a similar time in Clinton's presidency, where he'd just taken a shellacking from the Republicans.
Yeah, well, I think this is one of Obama's moments of strength. To be frank, I understand that he worked hard on this speech. When he takes a kind of intense personal interest in a speech, which presidents can only do so much, it tends to show. So my guess is that if people have a free minute, it might be worth tuning into this one.
So do you think that he can talk about the issues that have so inflamed the Palins of the Sarah Palins of the world? There's this ridiculous argument going on now where it's as though the political atmospherics of a toxic political environment is mutually exclusive with the notion that there's any responsibility. In other words, atmosphere can contribute, but it's not necessarily responsible for. Nobody says that, do they? But that's more or less.
No. Yeah, I mean, that's the way these conversations have long worked, Ian. You know, somebody, creates an environment or sort of eggs people on to destructive acts, and then they, raise their hands and say, my fingerprints aren't on it. I didn't do this. Certainly I would never sanction such a thing. And And meanwhile, then they get back to saying things like "take your country back by any means necessary," or putting congressional districts and the Congress people who sit in them in the crosshairs of a gun sight. These actions are inflammatory, and the difficulty is that we live in a time where people can profit in many, many ways from a kind of extremism, a kind of extreme set of ideas, and as importantly, behaviors. You know, it's interesting when you think about where the rhetoric is now versus where it was 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, it's actually so rather astonishing. You know, the idea that as we live in a time where claim can trump fact, where assertion overwhelms authenticity, where the charge can circle the globe, 20 times before the hard counterpoint of fact ever rears its head, people have, for political profit in many cases, or to incite their social movements, have new tools they can use. There's no doubt. And the outcome ends up being somebody has their reality show minute with an act of violence. And I think that's certainly part of what we're seeing here.
Again, I'm speaking with Ron Suskind, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, and we're talking in advance of President Obama's speech at the University of Arizona, where he's expected to speak in about 10 minutes from now. And what I find, though, offensive about the non-debate we're having, where people are shouting past each other, not that that's anything new, but I think it's quite offensive in a way that the Tea Party people and the conservatives on the Republican side, which is the Tea Party is essentially the right wing of the Republican Party, I think, for all intents and purposes. I don't know why these right wingers who always stand tall in the saddle and are quick to call the rest of us un-American, why they don't stand by their own words. They've been saying this stuff for the last couple of years, and now they're sort of calling a time out. It's almost sort of like the bully in the schoolyard, suddenly bleating and expecting some clemency.
Well, the trick to this dance of extremism is that on balance, most people in the country are not extremists. Sorry, there's a siren in front of where I'm standing. You know, they. The wide middle is where most of Americans live, and the difficulty though is that volume really works, and people start to ask themselves the question of how many people really believe in this sort of thing. The numbers are not nearly as large when you get right down to it as they seem. These things get magnified. The Tea Party itself drives debate, certainly from the right. And folks of that community, there's a strange kind of a misbegotten energy to it, because most people are affronted by it. Mm. Yet what you get is this dance that's happening right now, where folks are using these techniques. They're very savvy about how they work. They charge up. They fire up your base. That's the idea. But when something like this happens, it's a kind of what me? I had nothing to do with this. This is certainly an affront to everything I believe. It's interesting that thing that Sarah Palin did, which of course is creating its own little ruckus, where she got on to discuss this issue, and it was very interesting because it was very un-Palin-like. Not long after the shootings occurred, here she's got a slick 7-minute, a well-produced video. She's clearly reading from a script. She's talking about American themes, almost a president might. But she slips in there the word blood libel, that journalists and pundits or others are creating a blood libel that, the right wing of the Republican Party is behind this. I mean, my goodness. Of all terms, to throw into the mix, here you've got a Jewish congresswoman, the first Democrat to be elected from this district, who gets slaughtered, and you know, where do you come up with the word blood libel? Now, of course, many of the religious right listeners and followers of Sarah Palin know every bit what blood libel is. It's the old Jewish attack that Jews use the blood of Christian children in their rituals. It was one of the things that stood behind the Holocaust and the pogroms for, of course, centuries. I mean, what is that about? I mean, you just want to ask Sarah Palin, is that some signaling system to say, I'm saying this to all of you, but, you know, it got you a little wink. You know what I'm really sort of saying? I understand your pain. I don't know. Things like that, it leaves you dispirited, I suppose, about American public dialogue.
But Ron Suskin, do you think, though, that he, the president, who has been the object of these absolute outrageous tirades for so long, that he's that the most powerful political figure in Arizona just a couple of days ago said that the president shouldn't even come to Arizona unless he shows his birth certificate. In all of this stuff, that he's a terrorist-loving Muslim from Kenya who hates America and hates white people, they have been saying for the longest time these terrible things about the president, and whether or not you can connect them to what happened, you can certainly connect them to the political atmospherics in Arizona. And do you think it will be the moment for the president to speak out, because he's never defended himself?
Yeah, well, you know, I would put this in a category, of the race speech. You know, the president, this is his métier. This is his strong suit. When he is really challenged, and he has been really challenged by the vitriol from the right, you know, calling him every name in the book and all sorts of innuendos tucked in there, racial and otherwise. You know, this is where the president, you know, lifts the high arc, if you will. This is what essentially he feels it is his responsibility uniquely to do. And I think that's what you'll probably find today. You know, in some ways, moments like this provide opportunities for Barack Obama to essentially kind of a lift and reveal what I think most people would consider his best self, his strongest attributes. Again, which is what you saw on obviously the original sin and divisive issue of race. I mean, he was backed into a corner in the campaign, and look at that speech. You know, it's a thing of rhetorical and really intellectual beauty. And people said, wow, I haven't heard that sort of thing doing just what you're talking about. You know, we've talked by each other, around and through each other on race for a long time. Obama stepped up there and hit the key issues that we don't discuss on that race speech. And the question is, can he do that tonight on issues in some ways every bit as deep, intractable, and pronounced? The incredible vitriol and bunker-to-bunker conversation that's going on in America, the food fight that passes for a public dialogue. And I think right now it's something that would profit by doing, if you will. You know, if he can remind people in this speech tonight, oh, right, this is the guy that we elected. This is the guy who made me think and maybe made my eyes well up that time when I heard him. And even some Republicans say that, you know, this is his strong suit. So let's see if he can do it now to start his second term, his second half term, if you will, with something that reminds people about what first probably attracted them to Barack Obama and got him those 70% approval ratings in the first few months of his presidency.
Well, Governor Brewer is about to speak now, and I was just watching the president a second ago, and he's standing next to Sandra Day O'Connor on one side with his wife Michelle on the other. And it's because Sandra Day O'Connor is an Arizonan, but she's also somebody I think is kind of an exemplar in many ways of American centrism, arguably a part of the Republican Party that's now an endangered species. But nevertheless, she And I think the congresswoman who was shot also represent the American center. And the conventional wisdom now is that the president is trying to embrace the center. And so do you think he can hit a home run, since the right, I think to many people's eyes, has been discredited? At least they're on the defensive now. And my criticism, as I mentioned to you earlier on, is that they should man up and own what they've said and not be so mealy-mouthed. But that aside, do you think this is a moment for the president to reach out to the center?
I think it is. I mean, I think it is. You know what? That center is out there. That's the problem. It gets overwhelmed by the noise coming from each edge, but the wide middle is where most people live. And you know, I think mostly at this point they don't feel anyone really speaks for them. The political system has a kind of a siphoned off to either edge, the moderates or endangered species in all walks. And I think that's the trick for the president to not just offer a kind of, you know, we can come together speech, but to give it an edge, to give it a hard edge, in a way, kind of call people out to say, you know, at moments like this, silence is the dangerous thing, and people need to stand up and be counted, rather than just essentially let extremists carry the public dialogue wherever they decide it ought to go. And that's, I think, what people probably are hoping for and waiting for. You know, let's see a little of that toughness. Let's see a little of that fire. I mean, this is a time the president can show some fire in his belly, which sometimes is a little hard to detect.
Well, Ron Susskind, I thank you so much for joining us. I think the president will be speaking in a couple of minutes. Unless you have any other thoughts, I'll let you go, because I know you want to watch the speech as well.
Well, no, this is it's nice chatting in. I mean, I guess, you know, I think that the broader question here is Barack Obama now is in a position where, in a way, he needs to evolve, if you will. This is the story of the last couple months, and certainly the story of the next couple as well. And this may be an opportunity for that to happen. So I think that's the thing that might have wider import.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Ron Susskind. Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I've been speaking with Ron Susskind, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. His books include The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, and The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill. And he has been chronicling the presidencies of late, in particular, of course, the presidency of George W. Bush, or the co-presidency to many people's mind, along with Dick Cheney, who is very much the subject of the second book, The 1% Doctrine. I'm joined in the studio by Alan Minsky, the program director here at KPFK, who has been listening in on the speeches preceding the president's. And at the moment, we have Governor Jan Brewer is speaking, the governor of Arizona. And I believe the president is going to be on in a minute or so from now. Alan, rather than go to Governor Brewer's speech on the editorial assumption that it won't be particularly interesting, what is your take on what's happened so far?
Well, the young man who spoke before, who'd worked in Representative Gifford's office, who's a student at the University of Arizona, was a very touching and beautiful speech that occurred came off of the podium and was embraced by Barack Obama. It's a very very dramatic event. And, of course, historically, a lot of people are looking at today and drawing a parallel between President Clinton's talk after the Oklahoma City bombing. And I just am curious as to whether this can be the beginning of a similar type of rebound, not because Barack Obama might not capture this particular moment right. What he says tonight might be embraced. But remember that Bill Clinton and the comeback that Bill Clinton made, you know, speaking in terms of, you know, the career of this particular president, Barack Obama, versus the career of President Bill Clinton after he was trounced in the off-year elections in 1994. The midterm elections in 94, the Oklahoma City bombing occurred in 95, and then this was part of his comeback, you know, the staring down of Gingrich with the shutdown of Congress. People really
By the way, can I just interject one brief note? It's worth remembering that the perpetrator of the Oklahoma City bombing was a right-wing American terrorist who believes all of this stuff that the Tea Party have been putting out, this anti-government
stuff. Well, McVeigh,
Not that I'm saying that this guy, that the current assassin, believes anything. If he does, his mental processes.
My point quickly, though, in terms of the relative careers, people shouldn't forget, lest they get too caught up in the day-by-day events here, that, of course, Bill Clinton had an economy that was in a massive rebound mode already by 95. I mean, you didn't really see it in terms of the economic indicators until later on in the decade, mid-decade forward, but it's unlikely in terms of Barack Obama's the immediate future of Barack Obama's presidency, his standing in polls, his popularity, the state of America, how people are viewing Obama. Bill Clinton had a very powerful economy that was picking up in the mid-90s. That's not the case in the middle of Obama's first term. So up next is not President Obama yet, surprisingly.
Head of the Department of Homeland Security, the former governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano. Okay. And I don't know whether we should go to this speech or what, because we're still waiting for the president. He's supposed to be on now, according to the schedule we were given. But that mean a lot.
She might be introducing Barack Obama, and I suppose we can listen to Janet Napolitano again from the McHale Center on the University of Arizona campus in Tucson.
We know that the violence that occurred Saturday does not represent this community, this state, or this country. At these times, words can fail us. So let us listen instead to the words of the Old Testament. And I will provide a reading now from the book of Isaiah. Comfort, yes, comfort my people, says your God. Speak comfort to Jerusalem and cry out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places smooth. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their hosts by number. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? Have you not known, have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. This is the word of the Lord.
And that was former Governor Janet Napolitano, former governor of Arizona, now the head of the Department of Homeland Security, now the president of the university is back on, and I'm expecting him to introduce the president. And after the president has spoken, Alan Minsky and I will do a summary, if there's time, of what he said and the impact that we felt from his words. Alan, it looks like he hasn't really serious. Let's go to his introduction.
The Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder.
Boy, we're calling them here tonight. So this is not the president. This is the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder. So, Alan, again, we will decide here not to listen to Eric since we heard a little
from the Book of Isaiah.
Book of Isaiah from the previous speaker.
Well, I wasn't really expecting that,
well,
actually,
no,
from the Homeland
it's,
Security.
It's all very nice to get a little bit of the old-time religion, but let's talk a bit about what the president might do. I talked to Ron Suskind earlier about it, that this is a moment to reach out and consolidate his relationship with the center in this country where politics are lost and won. Here we are at a progressive radio station who spends most of our time attacking Obama. So what's your feeling on
Well, I mean, actually, the thing that strikes me that I think needs to be commented on about this, what's happened over the last week, is again to – because I think in the past few days, especially with Palin really grabbing the headlines, the manner in which this is taking place in a state which has just been racked by, you know, this war over migrant workers coming into the state and the reaction against their presence in the state, which has produced, you know, some of the most hateful racist rhetoric that we've seen in recent memory in the United States, and there's sadly not all that much of a shortage of that already. You know, everybody talks about in terms of the rhetoric of the Tea Party, and SB 1070 hasn't really been a focus of a lot of the dialogue in the mainstream media and even elsewhere concerning what took place with Gabrielle Giffords and Jared Loeffner. And I don't think that that can be put too far in the background. And the fact that Giffords eventually was outspoken in condemning SB 1070. So Eric Holder has left the stage now, and we're back again with the president of the University of Arizona.
And hopefully the president of the United States will be introduced by the president of the University of Arizona, because I'm anticipating this speech as Alan is, and I'm sure all of our listeners are. And we're just been waiting here for some time for it to happen. And this, I think, is a small indication of the great expectations that are being placed on this president to turn things around, to almost do the impossible. I was suggesting that he should stand up to what the Tea Party's been saying about him all these years, but he's apparently not going to do that. He's going to talk about healing the nation, which is obviously more understandable and more appropriate. Still, it's still worth, I think, at least one would hope that the president could put some context on why he's there and what led up to what happened, which has brought all of these people to the University of Arizona, to this memorial. And let's now I go to, I think he's about to introduce the president.
Your hope. Barack Obama assumed the presidency at a perilous time in our history. We are fortunate to have someone with his intellect, his energy, and his heart to lead us forward. Please welcome the President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Please, please be seated. Thank you. to the families of those we've lost, to all who called them friends, to the students of this university, the public servants who are gathered here, the people of Tucson, and the people of Arizona. I have come here tonight as an American who, like all Americans, kneels to pray with you today and will stand by you tomorrow. There is nothing I can say that will fill the sudden hole torn in your heart. But know this, the hopes of a nation are here tonight. We mourn with you for the fallen. We join you in your grief. And we add our faith to yours that Representative Gabrielle Giffords and the other living victims of this tragedy will pull through. Scripture tells us there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her. She will not fall. God will help her at break of day. On Saturday morning, Gabby, her staff, and many of her constituents gathered outside the supermarket to exercise their right to peaceful assembly and free speech. They were fulfilling a central tenet of the democracy envisioned by our founders. Representatives of the people answering questions to their constituents so as to carry their concerns back to our nation's capital. Gabby called it Congress on your corner, just an updated version of government of and by and for the people. And that quintessentially American scene, that was the scene that was shattered by a gunman's bullets. And the six people who lost their lives on Saturday, they too represented what is best in us, what is best in America. Judge John Roll served our legal system for nearly 40 years. A graduate of this university and a graduate of this law school. Judge Roll was recommended for the federal bench by John McCain 20 years ago. Appointed by President George H.W. Bush, and rose to become Arizona's chief federal judge. His colleagues described him as the hardest working judge within the Ninth Circuit. He was on his way back from attending Mass, as he did every day, when he decided to stop by and say hi to his representative. John is survived by his loving wife, Maureen, his three sons, and his five beautiful grandchildren. George and Dorothy Morris, Dot to her friends, were high school sweethearts who got married and had two daughters. They did everything together, traveling the open road in their RV, enjoying what their friends called a 50-year honeymoon. Saturday morning, they went by the Safeway to hear what their congresswoman had to say. When gunfire rang out, George, the former Marine, instinctively tried to shield his wife. Both were shot. Dot passed away. A New Jersey native, Phyllis Schneck, retired to Tucson to beat the snow. But in the summer, she would return east, where her world revolved around her three children, her seven grandchildren, and two-year-old great-granddaughter. A gifted quilter, she'd often work under her favorite tree, or sometimes she'd sew aprons with the logos of the Jets and the Giants to give out at the church where she volunteered. A Republican, she took a liking to Gabby and wanted to get to know her better. Dorwin and Mavi Stoddard grew up in Tucson together about 70 years ago. They moved apart and started their own respective families. But after both were widowed, they found their way back here to, as one of Mavi's daughters put it, be boyfriend and girlfriend again. When they weren't out on the road in their motorhome, you could find them just up the road, helping folks in need at the Mountain Avenue Church of Christ. A retired construction worker, Dorwin spent his spare time fixing up the church along with his dog, Tux. His final act of selflessness was to dive on top of his wife, sacrificing his life for hers. Everything Gabe Zimmerman did, he did with passion. But his true passion was helping people. As Gabby's outreach director, he made the cares of thousands of her constituents his own. Got the Medicare benefits that they had earned. The veterans got the medals and the care that they deserved. The government was working for ordinary folks. He died doing what he loved, talking with people and seeing how he could help. And Gabe is survived by his parents, Ross and Emily, his brother Ben, and his fiancée Kelly, who he planned to marry next year. And then there is 9-year-old Christina Taylor Green. Christina was an A student. She was a dancer. She was a gymnast. She was a swimmer. She decided that she wanted to be the first woman to play in the major leagues. And as the only girl on her little league team, no one put it past her. She showed an appreciation for life uncommon for a girl her age. She'd remind her mother, "We are so blessed. We have the best life." And she'd pay those blessings back by participating in a charity that helped children who were less fortunate. Our hearts are broken by their sudden passing. Our hearts are broken. And yet, our hearts also have reason for fullness. Our hearts are full of hope and thanks for the 13 Americans who survived the shooting, including the congresswoman many of them went to see on Saturday. I have just come from the University Medical Center, just a mile from here, where our friend Gabby courageously fights to recover, even as we speak. And I want to tell you, her husband Mark is here, and he allows me to share this with you. Right after we went to visit, a few minutes after we left her room and some of her colleagues from Congress were in the room, Gabby opened her eyes for the first time. Gabby opened her eyes for the first time. Gabby opened her eyes. Gabby opened her eyes, so I can tell you she knows we are here, she knows we love her, and she knows that we are rooting for her through what is undoubtedly going to be a difficult journey. We are there for her. Our hearts are full of thanks for that good news, and our hearts are full of gratitude for those who saved others. We are grateful to Daniel Hernandez, a volunteer in Gabby's office. And Daniel, I'm sorry, you may deny it, but we've decided you are a hero because you ran through the chaos to minister to your boss and tended to her wounds and helped keep her alive. We are grateful to the men who tackled the gunman as he stopped to reload. They're right over there. We are grateful for Patricia Mache, who wrestled away the killer's ammunition and undoubtedly saved some lives. And we are grateful for the doctors and nurses and first responders who worked wonders to heal those who'd been hurt. We are grateful to them. These men and women remind us that heroism is found not only on the fields of battle. They remind us that heroism does not require special training or physical strength. Heroism is here, in the hearts of so many of our fellow citizens, all around us, just waiting to be summoned, as it was on Saturday morning. Their actions, their selflessness, poses a challenge to each of us. It raises a question of what, beyond prayers and expressions of concern, is required of us going forward. How can we honor the fallen? How can we be true to their memory? You see, when a tragedy like this strikes, it is part of our nature to demand explanations, to try to impose some order on the chaos and make sense out of that which seems senseless. Already, we've seen a national conversation commence, not only about the motivations behind these killings, but about everything from the merits of gun safety laws to the adequacy of our mental health system. And much of this process of debating what might be done to prevent such tragedies in the future is an essential ingredient in our exercise of self-government. But at a time when our discourse has become so sharply polarized, at a time when we are far too eager to lay the blame for all that ails the world at the feet of those who happen to think differently than we do, it's important for us to pause for a moment and make sure that we're talking with each other in a way that heals, not in a way that wounds. Scripture tells us that there is evil in the world, and that terrible things happen for reasons that defy human understanding. In the words of Job, "When I looked for light, then came darkness." Bad things happen, and we have to guard against simple explanations in the aftermath. But the truth is, none of us can know exactly what triggered this vicious attack. None of us can know with any certainty what might have stopped these shots from being fired, or what thoughts lurked in the inner recesses of a violent man's mind. Yes, we have to examine all the facts behind this tragedy. We cannot and will not be passive in the face of such violence. We should be willing to challenge old assumptions in order to lessen the prospects of such violence in the future. But what we cannot do is use this tragedy as one more occasion to turn on each other. That we cannot do. we cannot do. As we discuss these issues, let each of us do so with a good dose of humility. Rather than pointing fingers or assigning blame, let's use this occasion to expand our moral imaginations, to listen to each other more carefully, to sharpen our instincts for empathy, and remind ourselves of all the ways that our hopes and dreams are bound together. After all, that's what most of us do when we lose somebody in our family, especially if the loss is unexpected. We're shaken out of our routines. We're forced to look inward. We reflect on the past. Did we spend enough time with an aging parent, we wonder? Did we express our gratitude for all the sacrifices that they made for us? Did we tell a spouse just how desperately we love them? Not just once in a while, but every single day. So some loss causes us to look backward, but it also forces us to look forward, to reflect on the present and the future, on the manner in which we live our lives and nurture our relationships with those who are still with us. We may ask ourselves if we've shown enough kindness and generosity and compassion to the people in our lives. Perhaps we question whether we're doing right by our children or our community, whether our priorities are in order. We recognize our own mortality. And we are reminded that in the fleeting time we have on this earth, what matters is not wealth or status or power or fame, but rather how well we have loved and what small part we have played in making the lives of other people better. And that process of reflection, of making sure we align our values with our actions, that, I believe, is what a tragedy like this requires. For those who were harmed, those who were killed, they are part of our family, an American family, 300 million strong. We may not have known them personally, but surely we see ourselves in them, in George and Dot, in Dorwin and Mavi. We sense the abiding love we have for our own husbands, our own wives, our own life partners. Phyllis, she's our mom or our grandma. Gabe, our brother or son. In Judge Roll, we recognize not only a man who prized his family and doing his job well, but also a man who embodied America's fidelity to the law. And in Gabby, we see a reflection of our public-spiritedness, that desire to participate in that sometimes frustrating, sometimes contentious, but always necessary and never-ending process to form a more perfect union. and in Christina. In Christina, we see all of our children. So curious, so trusting, so energetic, so full of magic, so deserving of our love, and so deserving of our good example. If this tragedy prompts reflection and debate, as it should, let's make sure it's worthy of those we have lost. Let's make sure it's not on the usual plane of politics and point scoring and pettiness that drifts away in the next news cycle. The loss of these wonderful people should make every one of us strive to be better. To be better in our private lives, to be better friends and neighbors and co-workers and parents. And if, as has been discussed in recent days, their death helps usher in more civility in our public discourse, let us remember it is not because a simple lack of civility caused this tragedy. It did not. But rather because only a more civil and honest public discourse can help us face up to the challenges of our nation in a way that would make them proud. We should be civil because we want to live up to the example of public servants like John Roll and Gabby Giffords, who knew first and foremost that we are all Americans and that we can question each other's ideas without questioning each other's love of country, and that our task, working together, is to constantly widen the circle of our concern so that we bequeath the American dream to future generations. They believed, and I believe, that we can be better. Those who died here, those who saved lives here, they helped me believe. We may not be able to stop all evil in the world, but I know that how we treat one another, that's entirely up to us. And I believe that for all our imperfections, we are full of decency and goodness, and that the forces that divide us are not as strong as those that unite us. That's what I believe, in part because that's what a child like Christina Taylor Green believed. Imagine for a moment. Here was a young girl who was just becoming aware of our democracy, just beginning to understand the obligations of citizenship, just starting to glimpse the fact that someday she too might play a part in shaping her nation's future. She had been elected to her student council. She saw public service as something exciting and hopeful. She was off to meet her congresswoman, someone she was sure was good and important and might be a role model. She saw all this through the eyes of a child, undimmed by the cynicism or vitriol that we adults all too often just take for granted. I want to live up to her expectations. I want our democracy to be as good as Christina imagined it. I want America to be as good as she imagined it. All of us, we should do everything we can do to make sure this country lives up to our children's expectations. As has already been mentioned, Christina was given to us on September 11th, 2001. One of 50 babies born that day to be pictured in a book called Faces of Hope. On either side of her photo in that book were simple wishes for a child's life. I hope you help those in need, read one. I hope you know all the words to the national anthem and sing it with your hand over your heart. I hope you jump in rain puddles. If there are rain puddles in heaven, Christina is jumping in them today. And here on this earth, we place our hands over our hearts, and we commit ourselves as Americans to forging a country that is forever worthy of her gentle, happy spirit. May God bless and keep those we've lost in restful and eternal peace. May He love and watch over the survivors. And may He bless the United States of America.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and you've been listening to the President of the United States, Barack Obama, speaking from the University of Arizona in Tucson. I believe we're going to go to the KPFK Evening News in progress. Alan Minsky?
Actually, Ian, we're going to quickly, before we go there, get your reflections on the talk, and I'll offer up a couple of mine, and we'll go in progress to the California report from KPFA, and we just need assurances that that's coming through live, and we'll go to it in a few minutes. But first, we're going to get some reflections on the speech from yourself and myself. And the thing that I have to say was, obviously, Barack Obama is a fantastic orator. He has quite the capabilities to step up to the moment, and I think we'll see, I expect in the press, we'll see great praise for his speech. But the thing that really struck me, well, actually 2 points, is while there was a lot, as you said, there's a lot of scripture. We heard Janet Napolitano earlier, Eric Holder, who we didn't play on KPFK, also cited scripture, and Barack Obama turned there very quickly, but only for 4 lines, and then went quickly, of course, to one of his great professional expertise, which is constitutional scholarship, and framed what was going on when the shooting occurred in terms of American democratic process. I thought that was done very eloquently. The second, and I think continually, if you look at the subtext of the speech, he returns back to the issues of American democracy, how we function within the Constitution and try to achieve democracy. But then I thought the major, you know, sort of point being made is, of course, in harmony not only with John Stewart and the Rally for Sanity, but in particular theme of the first years of the Obama presidency, which is a call for greater civility. He's always looking for everybody to participate, whether it's for bipartisanship, stretching, trying to get that one vote from the other side of the aisle. But he's seeking civility and participation in government. And these were the themes that I think he really emphasized here, which I don't think really would be surprising to anybody. And, of course, it was a very dramatically crafted speech.
Well, that is who Barack Obama is. I mean, I spoke with Robert Putnam from Harvard, who held these seminars when Obama was a constitutional scholar there at Harvard, and he did spend weekends with people like Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition, and he tried, and I think that is been who he is, and I think a lot of people think he should toughen up and take on the people who say these terrible things about him, but. You know, on the one hand, if he does that, I think he'd be accused by the right wing of this country of being an angry black man. So I think this was a very moving speech, and I think it was, I don't want to talk about the mechanics of it because, so much is the fact that he introduced you to these people who have died.
Right.
And he told you who they were and what they meant. And it is humbling. And we all should take note.
Right. No, he definitely – I mean, obviously, the crises that inform his presidency, they don't go away. And one of which, of course, is the now sizable majority that the opposition party has in the lower house of Congress. But in particular, the economic crisis, this does nothing to, change the way in which he has responded to the economy. But
I think that's that's a complete. He's been blindsided about that from day one, and that is a huge albatross.
Right, but as I said,
millstone. Right. What I don't know that his political fortunes are entirely tied up in this impatient American electorate that expects miracles. I mean, we were talking earlier that the best thing that could happen to him, just in a political sense, would be that Sarah Palin gets the nomination. And clearly she is ill-equipped to be a president of the United States, let alone dog catcher in Wasilla. But that is the situation we have. But just in terms of that speech, that was, I think, exactly what was required and should give us all pause to be less partisan, to be more open to deliberation and cooperation and less self-righteous about our political positions, and I think it'll pay off for him.
Well,
earlier, we may not like it. People on the left may not like it, but the center of American politics is the center.
There's no particular reason. Again, this wasn't. I suppose what I'm trying to get at is, this wasn't a content political speech. And, he did a masterful job, and his speechwriters along with him did a masterful job of framing what was going on there and why the people were drawn to the event, the people who were wounded or killed on Saturday in Arizona. They were there to participate in the democratic process, to meet with their representative. The political situation in Arizona is extremely tense, extremely heightened. So it's a very dramatic circumstance to go out into public, meet your congressperson. Nobody expected what happened would happen, of course. But, Barack Obama got to sort of bring to the American public the idea that this is a population that wants to participate. There are countless people across the society who desperately want to participate in a democratic society, democratic participation. And I think he framed that very well. That's what this event was about. I do think, though, in terms of the news, and we are a public affairs political talk radio station, the big issue is whether this speech will provide the same kind of boost to Barack Obama, whose poll numbers have been slightly improving over the past few weeks, that occurred with Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. I'd be hard-pressed to think that it won't. I mean, having listened to it, I think it will be received very positively.
Well, I think that the president was the country obviously requires political leadership, but I think he was reaching even above that to moral leadership. And I think he was very successful in that regard. It was it gives us all pause. I mean, I you know, saying earlier that I'd like to see him take on these Tea Party people who have been maligning him for so long. And that clearly didn't happen. And frankly, it's not appropriate. It's just how I feel and how a lot of partisan people
feel. But there was a request for more civil discourse. He said that. He could stick to that and point back to this occasion and to this speech. I think he's made an extremely high-profile speech where he's calling upon people to do that again. I mean, when you look at an event like this, I do think we're remiss as political journalists not to, frame this in terms of a politician who had the American population in the palm of his hand a little over 2 years ago, like nobody in recent times. And he fell so far, so fast to an overwhelming defeat in the midterm elections. And it's interesting
with the way that the media works and the political system works and
right.
the impatience.
And the economy,
of
course, too.
But just think for a moment, though, Alan, about what happened in this tragedy and how right. often these tragedies happen. That ought
sure.
to give us pause. This is a continuum. These things keep happening. You could not have invented a more stark kind of tragedy and a contrast between some poor, deranged, drug-addled kid who completely lost and influenced by the insane conspiratorial nonsense, which I rail against all the time. Compare that to the extraordinary person that this congresswoman turns out to be. I didn't know anything about her.
Mm-hmm.
She turns out to be a really interesting and wonderful woman. And her husband's an astronaut, for God's sake. And the kid that was killed,
Gabe Zimmerman.
His father works for the Dodger organization.
Oh no, that's Christine Green. You mean yes?
Kid.
Yeah, no,
was,
I know.
And was
I
killed, and then right. and then you've got the fact that the brother-in-law of the congresswoman is up in space now on the space
right.
station. He's in charge right. of the space station. So, if you wanted to sort of really stab America in the heart and hurt a lot of really good people, that's what this tragedy has done, and that's what this person has done. And just like Lee Harvey Oswald and all these hideous people, Bremer and the whole crowd of them, it's the thing that we can never get used to is that really stupid, low-life, idiotic people can cause incredible damage. And the fact that we can't explain that quite often has led to a lot of these conspiracy theories.
Well, again, my thought again about this particular speech is that unlike the State of the Union that's coming up where Obama's going to have to address some very uneasy issues, right? Because let's face it, America's – you know, he's going to have to speak about the war in Afghanistan. That's not going so pleasantly. He's going to have to speak about the economy. He's going to say it's turning around. Not many people are really going to believe him. This is an opportunity, though, to return. And one of the criticisms, of course, of Barack Obama that we've heard – across the political spectrum is that hope and change, the great themes of the 2008 campaign, you know, where was the substance to it? And this is an opportunity. It's that not that this was a substanceless speech, but an opportunity to just again reintroduce himself to the American public as somebody who can provide, a great moral message in a time of really just sort of heightened drama. And in that sense, Barack Obama is more than a serviceable public servant. He's exceptional in moments like this.
And, you know, he's basically challenged us all to do more work and to work to make the country better and stop criticizing and calling each other names and start trying to work together to solve these enormous problems. And none, of course, more, I think, appropriate at this moment than to deal with this obscenity with the proliferation of guns, with the fact that we cast away people like used Kleenex tissues and the streets are full of poor lost souls who are clearly mentally ill. These are a national disgrace, both the proliferation of guns and the lack of mental health care. So there's a place to start.
Well, and I obviously as the program director here currently, I just want to say that, of course, Pacifica Radio was founded on a mission of providing civil discourse. A caller has called in and said that Obama provided moral leadership in this talk, but now it's up to us, all of us, meaning all of you listening and all of us here in the society, to do the hard work. And that is actually part of what this radio station was – this radio network was founded to try to help achieve, was to bring about a civil discourse with great civility, as it were. And that's part of the challenge that was put forward here. And I think that, at least in the degree to which it was brought up, it obviously was speaking to the really aggressive rhetoric that is all over American political discourse right now. And I do believe shortly we're going to be going to the California report from the KPFA newsroom that we normally have on in the 6 o'clock hour. And Ian Masters, very honored to join you tonight.
Well, thank you, Alan Minsky, and I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing, engineer Devin Jordan. This has been an extended edition of Background Briefing. I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. Bye for now.